a lot of biodiversity risk travels down your supply chain. So there is a collateral benefit to assessing your biodiversity risk, which is getting to know your supply chain and getting to know the vulnerability in your supply chain, which once you know them, you will remove them.
Welcome to the Case for Conservation podcast, where we explore and sometimes interrogate topics in the field of biodiversity for the sake of a more robust case for its conservation. I'm your host, Andre Mada. You may have heard of the concept of biodiversity risk, especially in the context of business. It's become increasingly widely used in recent years, and the Task Force on Nature-Related Financial Disclosures, or TNFD, is a recent development that's done a lot to popularize the concept, at least in conservation circles. But what exactly is biodiversity risk? And for that matter, what is TNFD? And why has this topic been gathering so much steam lately? With us to demystify these and related questions is Janeta Sedilakova. She's director of the climate and biodiversity risk consultancy firm Climate Law Lab and biodiversity risk advisor at the Commonwealth Climate and Law Initiative, among other roles. I've probably never before been so out of my depth on an episode of the podcast, so this is a pretty basic exploration of the topic in which I tried to resolve some of my own uncertainty about it. Janeta is great at doing that, so if you're in a similar state of ignorance to mine, this is probably going to be an enlightening listen. I began by asking Janeta simply to explain what's meant by biodiversity risk and how she works in this area as a lawyer.
Biodiversity risk is a very broad term, and it's also a very new term. So right now, the way that biodiversity risk is categorized is based on how climate risk is categorized. So the categories of climate risk, established categories since 2015, are physical transition and liability climate risk. Mm-hmm. So this framework was lifted and shifted to biodiversity. And now we talk about physical transition and liability biodiversity risk. So biodiversity risk, all these three risks arise from degraded ecosystem and loss of biodiversity that compromise the ecosystem functions that the healthy ecosystem should deliver, but unhealthy ecosystem fails to deliver. So, you know, their source is different from the source of climate change. Source of climate change are greenhouse gases. Mm-hmm. Source of biodiversity risk is degradation of ecosystem, loss of biodiversity, which then results in degradation of ecosystem services. Mm-hmm. But the categorization, which we use in the commercial world to understand this risk, is the same. So we have physical transition and liability biodiversity risk. Now, physical and transition biodiversity risks, I can give you some examples. So the physical risk arises from loss of biodiversity that compromises the ecosystem services, the delivery of ecosystem services, and results in some sort of physical impact. Mm-hmm. So you can think about landslide, for example, when ecosystem service of soil retention control or soil regulation mm-hmm. is compromised because trees are cut, the grass dies, the soil stability is compromised, and then you have a landslide. And it can mm-hmm. damage buildings, it can damage infrastructure. And that's your physical biodiversity risk. We lost biodiversity. It compromised the ecosystem functions. The soil got dislocated and it resulted in a landslide, which caused physical damage. That's a physical biodiversity risk. Mm-hmm. Transition biodiversity risks arise from transition to a nature positive economy. So that transition could be technological. We could have new technologies that will displace existing technologies. It could be legal as well. So we could have new laws or regulation coming in place, prohibiting the use of biodiversity in some way. Mm-hmm. So when I go back to the soil degradation example I gave you, we could see regulation coming in place that will prohibit building of resorts or hotels on a particular land that doesn't have the same stability as is required by law. And imagine that there are hotels and resorts built on land that is getting degraded because of the soil degradation to a point that that land on which it is built doesn't meet the standard required by law. Mm-hmm. In that case, that's a transition risk that the hotel faces, because transitioning to the nature positive economy means that the hotel will have to be abandoned as a business asset. It will no longer give you the economic return you expect to get from that hotel. This is called, so the assets that have to be abandoned because of the transition to the nature positive economy, we call them stranded assets. So the idea is that when you build the asset, you expect the return for 50 years, but all of a sudden you get 20-year return. So the asset has lost its economic value before the expiry of its economic life.
Mm-hmm.
So that's your transition risk. And liability risk, the last type of biodiversity risk, as we categorize them, is a risk that arises from, it is attached and arises from the mismanagement of the physical and transition risk. So you fail to consider the physical risk and then there is a damage, or you fail to consider the transition risk and all of a sudden you are out of business. Those are big mistakes of managers, right? Because managers need to consider risk.
Mm-hmm.
And because these are quite grievous, quite big mistakes, your shareholders, for example, can have a recourse against you. They could sue you because you have failed to safeguard their interest as shareholders. And that is where lawyers like me come in. So we look at the liability risk, specifically for one of my clients, Commonwealth Climate and Law Initiative. I analyze biodiversity liability risk and look at how it can arise for directors and officers of big corporations. And then obviously we look at how currently, under the current legal framework, directors and officers can mitigate this risk, therefore mitigate their exposure to lawsuits.
Mm-hmm. Is it only shareholders that can file a suit, or is it other stakeholders? Because there's a lot of talk these days of stakeholder capitalism and stakeholders rather than shareholders, or is this just purely in the domain of shareholders?
So when you talk about biodiversity litigation, biodiversity liability risk, which is a risk of being sued as a company or a director, it's a broad category.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, you can have different type of people bring a claim against a company. So usually to bring a claim against the company under most legal system around the world, I don't want to focus on any particular because I know that your listeners are from around the world. In most systems around the world, to be able to bring a claim against the company, you have to have suffered either personal injury or physical damage. So there has to be a wrong done to you so that you can bring a lawsuit.
Mm-hmm.
And we do have some cases where a mismanagement of a company's tailings in Brazil, tailing dam in Brazil, you know, has caused damage to local people, their health, property, and livelihoods, and they're bringing that company before courts in the UK. We mm-hmm. have cases like that. But what we don't have is the recognition of what I call pure environmental damage. So environmental damage, which has no human victim or no property victim, mm-hmm. if you can call property a victim, property damage consequence.
Mm-hmm.
And in most Commonwealth systems, so systems that have inherited English common law as the basis in the past and now are independent of English common law, in most of these systems, it's really hard to bring a case for pure environmental damage.
Mm-hmm.
The reasons are numerous. Often it is the task of the government agency to bring these cases. So in the UK, we have the Environment Agency, which is supposed to bring these cases. But for example, because of their budget cuts over the past years, we have seen very few cases for what I call pure environmental damage.
Mm-hmm.
Or many of jurisdictions, again, based on English common law, do not recognize natural objects such as forests or rivers that have mm-hmm. legal rights. Our species, exactly. And therefore, these natural assets cannot bring a case. Now, having said that, there is an increasing trend in biodiversity litigation, or I would even say biodiversity legislation, where we see natural assets, mostly rivers, recognized as rights holders. And this is happening also in Commonwealth jurisdiction. So we've seen rivers recognized in India and Canada and the US. We have seen New Zealand recognize a river as a holder of a right. And when you have this kind of new legal personality created for natural assets, it gives possibility for that natural asset to actually sue for damage caused to it, which hasn't caused any damage to people. This is a very theoretical example, I should say, because we haven't seen a case like that yet, but the trend continues around the world. And I don't dare to say when we will see a river suing a company, but I do think that will happen in the coming years. I do really believe, because it's such a, you know, such a progressive agenda, such a progressive development of law, mm-hmm. that it will have huge repercussions on redress for the damage caused to natural assets. Now, mm-hmm. to finish answering your question.
Can I just ask, just to sidetrack you a little bit, but in that river example, obviously it's not the river itself that's suing. So is it anybody who, if that were to come to pass, it means that anybody...
It depends on how the either legislation that awarded rights to that river or the forest is awarded, or how the court decided. So these natural assets are awarded, we call it legal personality, so given rights, either by courts in a litigation or by statute passed by parliament. Mm-hmm. So it really depends how this is awarded. We have seen statutes and courts create something like a stewardship committee for the natural asset that will exercise its rights, which makes sense because you would have some experts in the committee, they'll be independent. So it's the same as directors exercise rights on behalf of a company. You have mm-hmm. a stewardship committee to exercise rights on behalf of a river. Now, having said that, your point about anybody being able to bring a claim is valid because there is a legislation around the world which actually says the same. So, you know, it's a matter of choice. It's either a stewardship committee or anybody. Really, anybody can bring the case to the court. So there are the two approaches we have seen around the world. And indeed, it's the matter of choice which one will be adopted. And perhaps in future, it will be a matter of practice as to which one will be more successful.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Now, just going back to that question, I just mm-hmm. want to address one aspect which I didn't. So I was talking about this broad biodiversity litigation, which is much broader than litigation against directors. It's litigation against governments, litigation against companies. You have many more stakeholders that could be, or many more defendants in these types of cases. But when we talk about suing directors, in most jurisdictions around the world, that can only be done by shareholders. Mm-hmm. And usually they sue on behalf of the company. So in that very narrow context of biodiversity litigation, indeed, you are looking at shareholders having mm-hmm. to bring a claim. In the UK, the means they bring a claim is called derivative action. So essentially, they derive standing from the company that has been harmed or mm-hmm. allegedly harmed by the director's actions or failures. And then they essentially sue directors for those actions and failures. And they do it on behalf of the company because mm-hmm. the company was harmed.
Okay.
But that's a very narrow context of that litigation against directors. When you have litigation against companies or governments, then obviously other people could have standing depending on the damage caused or depending on whether a natural asset is recognized as a holder of rights.
Okay. So in a case like that, the company, when you say the company is harmed, then that obviously harms the shareholders as well. And that could happen because, or that does happen because of the company's negligence in looking after biodiversity, essentially, and the penalties that are incurred because they haven't done that, right?
That could be one example of a case. So again, the cases could be numerous. And, you know, like litigation, especially in the environmental domain, in climate change and biodiversity, the litigation is becoming different from the traditional litigation where you just litigate to protect your personal interest. What we see in climate change and increasingly in biodiversity is a strategic litigation, where the claimants are thinking about what do we want to achieve by this case. It's not only a question of getting a redress for a particular harmed entity or individuals, which mm-hmm. is also very important, especially in the context of disadvantaged minorities like indigenous people or just, you know, people who are marginalized because of their poverty status, for example. So there is definitely importance of getting redress for these people as well. Mm-hmm. But there is also the wider aim of bringing this issue to the attention of the public, making noise about it. So strategic litigation is so much broader. So what you have described in your question was one example. So the company, directors ignoring biodiversity risk or being, you know, essentially not educating on them enough. Mm-hmm. So they make a decision for, you know, expansion of the company's business. But the way they expand is harming biodiversity on which that company depends. And then all of a sudden, in a couple of years, that business is unviable because the ecosystem service that provided the resources for that business is no longer functioning because the biodiversity has been depleted. Mm-hmm. And in that case, as a shareholder, you would be thinking, well, they have made a decision, but it was very clear that that biodiversity risk was present at the time they made it. They ignored it. They were negligent. They have breached what we call their duty. And the duty that often we engage in the UK is a duty to promote success of the company. And the second duty is the duty to act with due care, skill, and diligence. Mm-hmm. And when you think about it, if there is a huge biodiversity risk to the company's business, and a director who should know about this risk doesn't consider that risk, he's not skilled enough, right? His duty to exercise due care, skill, and diligence is not complied with. So when the company suffers business losses, 5 years down the line, 10 years down the line, then that's the harm to the company and the harm to the shareholders' profits, obviously. So that that's how the claim can be brought. But again, this is just one example of a lot of examples or, you know, test cases that you could come up with in the context of biodiversity litigation. The one that you discuss is really the narrow focus on company being harmed and then suing the directors for the losses.
Okay. So you mentioned the example that you just gave now was if the company harms biodiversity, which upon which it depends in some way. And I guess fisheries could be a good example there, right? Damaging the area that they rely on for fishing could harm their ability to pull fish out in the future, right? So something like that. But what about if a company harms biodiversity that it doesn't depend on at all? Is that still part of this realm or is that outside of it?
That categorization is what is on our minds all the time now, because you're right, if company harms biodiversity depends on and its business, its returns diminish, then it's almost common sense to say you should have known, guys, right? Like you should have known that depleting fish stock, which you fish out and sell, means that your business will go bust, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you are damaging the biodiversity you're dependent on. And it's not so difficult to mitigate that risk, because biodiversity can renew itself, right? The tree grows after fire and what it needs to renew its time. So to manage the biodiversity you are dependent on effectively and consciously is just to not to deplete it to a point beyond which it cannot renew and regenerate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm not a person who to advise on timelines, but I can definitely see that it is about extraction of natural resources, which is considered of the ability and potential of nature to restore and renew that natural asset that you extract. Mm-hmm. So, you know, management of this risk to your own dependencies is not that difficult, in my opinion. Obviously, maybe mathematically, economically, it must be calculated, but the general formula is there. Give biodiversity time to renew itself, and then it will supply the services forever for you.
Yeah.
So, what if the company impacts biodiversity that it doesn't depend on, but maybe other companies can depend on, or nobody really depends on? Nature depends on it. So no human being or human creation like a company trust depends on it.
Mm-hmm.
This is a question that we are exploring. There are legal arguments that you can construct to say there is a potential to sue, but they are not as established or recognized or really firm. Mm-hmm. As the argument saying if company depends on biodiversity that it destroys, then obviously there is a recourse through the director's duties or general negligence. So right now, I cannot give you answer to that question simply because it's under exploration.
Mm-hmm.
The report that we wrote in December 2022, I can send it to you to put into the notes of the podcast. It's called Biodiversity Risk, Legal Implications for Companies and Their Directors. So my colleague Jenny Ramos and I wrote this report together with Commonwealth Climate and Law Initiative. And we actually look at the question of, okay, if a company destroys biodiversity, it's not dependent on, but other companies are dependent on, can those companies sue? Or is there a recourse by shareholders? There is no clear answer to that question. That is something that we will have to be watching. It will probably, you know, think about how law develops. First, you answer the easier questions and then you go to harder.
Mm-hmm.
So I expect, you know, maybe in 10 years, we will have first lawsuits of this kind that will be exploring the territory, because that liability is far from established, simply because it's quite remote from the liability chains that we often see in law.
Yeah, no, that's very enlightening. I've just been wondering about this for a while, actually, you know, because when you read and hear about biodiversity risk in the business context, it's seldom really made clear exactly what is being spoken about. And actually, that brings me to the next question, which was about TNFD. So recently, perhaps the most sort of commonly heard catchphrase in the field of business and biodiversity risk is this Task Force on Nature-Related Financial Disclosures, or TNFD. And I know that TCFD is the climate-related one, which has been around for a bit longer. I'm not sure exactly how relevant this is going to be to the conversation, but it seems like it might be. So I want to just ask if you wouldn't mind just briefly explaining what TNFD is and what they do relative to what you do.
So TNFD is developing disclosure framework that companies, big companies, should disclose against, and what they will disclose are the biodiversity risk. That is the overarching framework. So companies mm-hmm. will be told how to assess their impact and dependencies on nature, and then mm-hmm. there'll be criteria which the companies will have to apply to see which of those risks are material enough to be disclosed, very much like companies disclose their financial information in their annual reports, financial statements. So this will be non-financial disclosure, because it will be disclosure of their biodiversity risks. Essentially, what those biodiversity risks would be, and we are coming back to my first answer to your question, mm-hmm. which was, you know, we have these physical transition liability biodiversity risks. Now, TNFD is concerned with the physical and transition risks. They are talking about disclosure, assessment of these risks by the company, and disclosure of those that are material, which essentially means they can impact the financial performance of the company.
Mm-hmm.
And TNFD doesn't really talk about liability risk, because as I said, liability risk is dependent on management, mismanagement, or complete ignorance of the physical and transition risk.
Mm-hmm.
But as you can see, there is a connection. So clearly, TNFD disclosures are relevant to our work from several angles, one of which is when TNFD recommendations are published, which will be final recommendations will be published in September 2023, we will know the framework that they suggest for nature-related financial disclosures. And what we have seen with the climate-related task force, which published its recommendations in 2017,
mm-hmm.
we saw quite a fast adoption of those recommendations into legislation or into, you know, law in several countries. New Zealand and UK were one of the first two pioneers in this. So we expect the recommendations by the Task Force on Nature-Related Financial Disclosures to have similar effect when they are published in September 2023. So there mm-hmm. are several governments around the world, including the UK, who said that they'll be looking to implement these recommendations into legal frameworks in the country. And once that is law, certain companies, and we are always talking about quite big companies, there will be a financial threshold for the disclosure.
Mm-hmm.
They will have to start disclosing against these criteria. And obviously, there will be companies, there will be strategic litigants scrutinizing these disclosures, looking at their quality, looking at their impact, and searching for information in these disclosures as to whether the company is really doing what it says it's doing, whether it's running greater risks that it should be running.
Mm-hmm.
And all this information can form a basis, an evidentiary basis, if you will, for lawsuits against directors, for example. Because disclosures could be labeled, if the disclosures are made negligently or dishonestly, which is quite a high standard, but negligence is much lower,
mm-hmm.
they could potentially lead to a breach of directors' duties, because directors mm-hmm. do sign on the disclosures, right? They mm-hmm. have to satisfy themselves as part of their roles that the disclosure reflects the real position of the company, the real position of the company. So TNFD on its own doesn't deal with liability, biodiversity liability at all.
Mm-hmm.
But biodiversity liability doesn't stand on its own. It is derived from the physical or transition biodiversity risk.
Yeah,
so the disclosures could form basis of the liability risk, depending on their quality, of their diligence, and in some cases of their honesty.
And TNFD is global, right? It's supposed to apply around the world to all countries and all systems of law. Is that right?
So it is not a legal framework. TNFD is a market-led initiative. Mm. So they are trying to make the framework generally applicable. You're right. So because it's not attached to a particular legal system, it means it would be generally applicable everywhere. And then legislators in different countries would take the framework and incorporate the framework into their particular legal structure. So whether it's a legislation or the framework could be taken by judges and adapted into the system through common law, which I do not expect, to be honest, that could be quite rare. It's usually the legislators who take the framework and make it legally binding on corporate actors in a particular jurisdiction.
Okay.
But as such, it's a market-led initiative, so it should be jurisdiction agnostic. It should be easily implemented in each jurisdiction.
Mm-hmm. And what's the benefit for a company? I mean, let's say it's not enshrined in the legal system. In that case, like, what's in it for a company to be involved in TNFD or to take part?
So obviously, if it's a legal obligation, they have no choice. So in the countries where it will be made into legal obligation, you know, it's not your choice. You have to do it. Other than that, the disclosure has a huge reputational value to companies.
Okay, I thought that might be the answer, yeah.
Yeah, reputational, because shareholders and potential new investors will be looking at your even impact beyond finance into your environmental footprint. So broader than climate, sometimes even broader than biodiversity. But fundamentally, I think there is one really important financial reason to be engaged in such disclosures. And it is, we know from COVID-19 pandemic that our supply chains, our value chains are extremely vulnerable to shocks. They are not resilient. They you know, essentially circle the globe three times before the goods gets to you. Mm-hmm. And a lot of biodiversity risk travels down your supply chain. So there is a collateral benefit to assessing your biodiversity risk, which is getting to know your supply chain and getting to know the vulnerability in your supply chain, which once you know them, you will remove them. You will make your company, your supply chains more resilient against future shocks, be it shocks of pandemics or biodiversity of climate change. Once you know that your supply chain has these almost bottlenecks that makes it very susceptible to shocks, you will remove them, you will manage them, you will mitigate them.
Yeah.
So I think that's a huge collateral benefit that many companies should be very keen to gain given what we have experienced in COVID-19 pandemic.
Right. So that sort of applies to every company and every producer that's upstream from the company in question.
Yeah.
Okay, so you mentioned that sort of in theory, TNFD is kind of a global thing, but you in your work are working specifically with English common law, right?
With Commonwealth Climate and Law Initiative, we are working with jurisdictions that inherited Commonwealth system. Uh-huh. So it is English law, part of which is English common law. So common law usually refers to the precedent law, whereas English law would refer also to legislation, but it's such a technical legal, you know, term that you can edit it all out, really.
Mm-hmm.
But the important thing is, so Commonwealth Climate and Law Initiative works with the jurisdictions with the Commonwealth heritage.
Mm-hmm.
So we, obviously, it's UK, as you have said, but also we look at Australia, Canada, South Africa, India. So, you know, jurisdictions that would have had some link to the former Commonwealth, to the Commonwealth currently, in some form, and therefore their legal systems would have inherited English law. And the reason is because obviously there is a possibility to compare them.
Right.
And the comparison, the legal duties of directors, which is the focus of Commonwealth Climate and Law Initiative, they are not identical, but they are overlapping to an extent where you can draw inspiration from one jurisdiction and bring it to another.
In countries where companies and the legal system and the government in general is taking biodiversity and harm to biodiversity seriously, if those countries are putting extra restrictions on companies and the way that they do things, is there a risk that that could drive business? You know, we live in a global economy, right? Is there a risk that that could drive business to the parts of the world that are less responsible about doing things, that care less about doing things? And I guess this is not restricted to this conversation. This is sort of a general phenomenon, right?
But I was just thinking, like, you're talking, like, as we have tax havens, we are talking about creating biodiversity havens, in a sense.
Right.
There is always that risk. You know, if there is a global movement which is implemented in some countries into law sooner than others, you always have that risk of companies just, you know, essentially moving their headquarters or incorporating elsewhere. So you will always have that risk. In litigation, it's called forum shopping. So if you can sue one company in four mm-hmm. jurisdictions, you will choose the one which is the most favorable to your cause. So, you know, it works in regulatory aspects, it works in corporate law, it works in contentious area of law such as litigation. So mm-hmm. there is the risk. One thing that I would say is that risk is, I'm not saying it's mitigated, but it exposes you to other risks. So if you move, obviously there is a huge reputational risk that you run because the media will pick on it. So in the civil society, democratic society, you cannot do these things silently. If you are a big corporation, you will not be able to do these things silently. Mm-hmm. And the reputational risk and reputational harm comes with, you know, risk of losing your customers. Mm-hmm. And we know that with Gen Z gaining more purchasing power, the environmental concerns are really becoming the main concerns of the consumers. So you are potentially looking at losing your consumer bases. You're looking at perhaps losing your shareholders as well because of that move, because we know that there are more and more activist shareholders. So shareholders demanding that the companies they invest in actually look at their not only environmental criteria, but sometimes wider ESG, environmental, social, and governance criteria, and assess whether they're running any risks or having any negative impacts in these areas. So, mm-hmm. you know, the society we live in makes reputational harm and the risk to your reputation extremely potent in making these decisions to, I would say, almost flee obligations in one country and go to another one. Mm-hmm. And the risk really can then impact your return as a company, because obviously losing customers means losing income and losing shareholders mean losing investment. So mm-hmm. there are financial risks that you would be running by, you know, engaging in such behavior.
Mm-hmm. But another way that this could play out is that the company doesn't move, but the business moves, or the customers move, you know, so the companies are complying in a certain, let's say country A is compliant and super biodiversity friendly and doing everything that they can. And as a result, they lose competitive advantage at the global scale because another country that's not paying attention to this is just making a lot more money because of fewer regulations. Yeah. And I take what you said about Generation Z, but globally, you know, probably the main driver of consumer choice is still going to be cost, right?
I know what you mean. And you are like, you know, my answer I do accept might have been a bit idealized because you are right. Like the drive, if you start doing something more responsibly, which often in the current society means you internalize your negative externalities, right? So mm-hmm. negative externalities commonly are negative impacts of business activity, which historically have been left on the taxpayers and the governments to deal with. What we see as a movement now in law and economics is the call for internalizing the externalities. Mm-hmm. But if you internalize these negative externalities, you have more costs. So your example is absolutely logical and we see it. And this is where the government really come in. So moving incentives and subsidies to businesses that actually do it and, you know, providing these subsidies to them so that their product actually can maintain the competitive edge is extremely, extremely important. Because otherwise, you're right, we will have this weird society where the businesses who do the right thing will be driven out of the business by the businesses who do the wrong thing. And then, you know, that unfortunately has been the economy we have been functioning in so far, mm-hmm. and it has proven quite destructive for our planet. So mm-hmm. there are a lot of arguments. You know, you can have the cross-generational justice argument where we talk about leaving the planet, at least in the state we got it, for future generations as well. But yeah, your point is absolutely valid. And that is where governments really step in to, as they did in the past, to almost equalize the power of the past with the power of the future. So to make the competition on the market fair. especially for the early entrants. And a lot of these early or, you know, new entrants will be startups who will be coming with new ideas. So the funding there and the stream of finance to startups is already established, especially in the progressive economies. So, you know, you would hope that that funding will then perpetuate further with the business once they reach the competitive status of big players. The funding will no longer be startup funding. It will be subsidy funding, but it will stay with the startup until they actually compete on a fair market, compete on a market where externalities mm-hmm. of every business are internalized, and therefore the product mm-hmm. bear the cost they should bear, which is not only the cost of production, but also the cost of their impact, the negative impact that they have.
Yeah, that opens up a whole Pandora's box there. And I guess I realize that we're going well beyond the legal realm here as well. So, I think I need to do an episode on ESG in general at some stage, because it's such a huge topic.
Yeah, there's a lot of criticism, and I recognize the need to be more nuanced, especially in ESG.
Mm-hmm. The whole idea of environmental accountability in the legal system is nothing new, because environmental impact assessment and strategic environmental assessment and the laws around those have been going for a long time, but that's kind of at a pretty local level. But what you've been talking about, what TNFD have been doing, and what you and your firm are doing is at a much bigger scale. It's kind of, you know, things have been scaled up. And I was just wondering if you have any idea of, you know, why, and we spoke at the beginning about this a bit as well, why this has just quite suddenly sort of exploded onto the scene. And do you think that it's robust enough to last? Because sometimes I wonder whether this is a bubble that could mm-hmm. burst at some stage. Do you think it's robust? As I mentioned to you, robustness is kind of, I think, one of the most critical aspects of conservation. So do you think that this field is robust?
That's a really good question. And I have to say, I still get approached by lawyers who think this is just a bubble. I do have conversations with lawyers who just don't believe biodiversity will ever be a liability risk, a real liability risk. Mm-hmm. So, you know, a very important question to be asked. So I think, just to answer the first part of your question, the momentum that we see now has been created by joint forces. It wasn't a single force, but joint forces of market regulation, science and law, really. So I think it benefited from climate change rising into the global agenda of, you know, all players, market regulators, litigators, as one of the big issues we need to address. And climate change compared to biodiversity is quite easy. And I don't want to downplay how difficult it is to address, mitigate, adapt to climate change at all. But what mm-hmm. I mean by mm-hmm. easy is the calculation. Climate change is caused by greenhouse gases, sometimes, you know, CO2 mm-hmm. equivalents, but we have a metric there. Biodiversity is much more complex. So it's just natural to kind of almost delay something that is complex, because we like to avoid complexities and we like to compartmentalize, and complexities are really difficult to compartmentalize. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the delay is somewhat natural, but I think biodiversity has benefited from the climate narrative, especially when the narrative came to nature-based solutions. And we started talking about carbon sinks. So carbon sinks being natural ecosystems that essentially draw or suck carbon out of the atmosphere and store it. So, you know, forests are the common one, but we have wetlands, we have marshes, mangroves, all these huge complex ecosystems can store a lot of carbon, and therefore they help us mitigate climate change. So all these kind of almost biodiversity and nature entering the realm of climate change. And I think through that, there is the huge realization of how different biodiversity is from climate change, and therefore how nuanced we have to be in addressing biodiversity loss. Mm-hmm. And from that, you started having these, I think, task force on nature-related financial disclosure. First time I noticed it was 2020 when it was set up. So, you know, that's 3 years ago. And then we started getting market signals. So with the task force, because it was set up by market players, the more people join, there is the more acknowledgement, the common acknowledgement that this is an issue. This is an issue for us, and we have to address it for our own sake. Mm-hmm. You know, we are not doing this philanthropically out of good hearts. We are doing this for the business sake. And then you started having the negotiations, so the COP50 negotiations, the 15th conference of parties to the Convention on Biological Diversity, mm-hmm. which is a legal instrument, international legal instrument that has been quite dormant for a couple of years. But now COP15, that was held in December, was a big momentum. And the documents that came out of it, they are not actually legally binding agreements, mm-hmm. but the consensus that came out of it in the shape of global biodiversity framework, although it's not a legally binding document, the words adopted are quite ambitious, and they can be used in law as well as an interpretative tool. We call it soft law if you want the legal term. Mm-hmm. So you had this like market movement with the task force, and then thousands of reports published that I can't even mention because I lost track of them. Then you started having, you know, the lawyers started looking into this as a liability risk. We started getting reports. We have international negotiations. We have few cases. So we have, I keep talking about biodiversity liability risk as a general thing, but there are already some examples of cases which track supply chains, which track ownership structures and bring biodiversity loss calls in Brazil before the courts in the UK. So we start getting these cases, which again, is a liability risk in creation. It's an emerging liability risk. Mm-hmm. So I think there are a lot of market factors, regulatory factors, legal factors, and social factors. People started caring much more. And I know when I say people, it's the people in the Western society, the people who are comfortable enough to care. And I really want to emphasize that. And I don't want to diminish value of anybody's decision making, but people whose primary needs are not satisfied obviously do not have capacity to care about these things, and that's a legitimate, very legitimate position. But we can see the consumer societies which drive biodiversity loss to a large extent, the consumers in these societies started caring, the investors started caring. So it's really a combination of several forces that do reinforce each other. They do impact each other because we lawyers look at market development. We look at regulatory development, but none of them on their own would create a momentum. They had to really collide in the same year or perhaps same decade to create the momentum we have now. And honestly, it would have to, for the momentum to die out, it would have to have the same diminishment of these joint forces at the same time for the momentum to die out. I don't think that will happen simply because the momentum is created by reinforcement of different forces, and if one dies out at this stage, some other force will reinforce it, if you know what I mean. But I don't think we will lose the momentum. I think it will start culminating more and more, but it's a valid question that even today, when we have some biodiversity cases where we have a lot of market shifts and regulatory shifts, there are still some lawyers in my field who doubt that biodiversity will actually materialize as a liability for corporations in future.
Next time, my plan is to dig into the topics of echo chambers and filter bubbles and how they affect the way that we understand the world, especially in terms of conserving biodiversity. My guest is Russell Galt, Head of Policy and Science at Earthwatch Europe, and an old friend. Neither of us are experts in this topic, but we have been thinking about it for a while, and I asked Russell because of how much I value his sincerity and his insight into virtually any topic, especially related to conservation. I think this is one of the most profound and influential and under-discussed issues of our time, and it applies to anyone who uses the internet or social media, i.e. everyone. We'll focus on conservation, but probably also range a bit more widely than that and discuss how echo chambers and filter bubbles affect society more broadly. I think this is going to be a really interesting discussion, and I'm really looking forward to it, and I do hope you can join us.